Did you know that collagen makes up 30% of the protein in your body? It's the substance that gives structure, support, and strength to your skin, muscles, bones, and connective tissues. Collagen is what keeps our skin firm and youthful, preventing it from sagging. It also supplies amino acids that are crucial for building healthy hair and protecting hair follicles. The collagen supplement that I use and recommend to my patients is Revive by Bright Core Nutrition. Revive combines five types of collagen with hyaluronic acid and biotin to heal and nourish your skin, hair, and nails. Studies show that collagen also helps relieve joint inflammation and pain. If you're looking to heal your body from the inside out and reverse some effects of aging, Revive could be your answer. For more information and to order, visit mybrightcore.com/Hoffman. That's mybrightcore.com/Hoffman or call 888-592-9909. That's 888-592-9909. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, buy two bottles of Revive and get one free, plus a collagen sheet mask as a free gift. That's mybrightcore.com/Hoffman for Revive Multi-Collagen Protein. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to interview one of my favorite guests, and I try to be diplomatic about this because I love all our guests, but I have an extra special high regard for today's guest, Cheryl Atkison, who's an investigative reporter and managing editor of the Sunday TV show Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. She is an extraordinary source of information about what is in our wheelhouse for intelligent medicine. She takes a critical view of the medical establishment, of big pharma, of big agriculture, and she's got a great book. The book is entitled Follow the Science, How Big Pharma Misleads, Obscures, and Prevails. We previewed her book this summer before it came out. And it's now out. It's been out since this fall. And it's really proving prescient because we really have a moment in terms of our healthcare system. A lot of people challenging assumptions about our healthcare system and about wellness. And her book directly addresses that. And so I'm just going to slate and go because she's got a lot to share with us. Cheryl, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Okay. So, look, you were with a major network at the beginning of your career. You were with CBS. You were an award-winning journalist, recipient of five Emmy Awards and the prestigious Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting. How is it that you found constrained in your health reporting, and now you've become an independent journalist? And I think this also reflects on the state of the media in America these days. Why is it that you can't report from, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC, Evening News?
Nobody who wants to do this line of reporting can report fairly at these entities anymore, which is a far cry from 2000 when I was first assigned to look into medical controversy at CBS News. Everybody was covering them. I can't think of fewer things that are more important. I'm not a medical reporter. I'm an investigative reporter and a general assignment reporter. And as I approached these controversies, I was shocked to find similar themes in covering medical controversies as I had found in covering government and corporation scandals, with a lot of conflicts of interest, ethical violations, whistleblowers wanting to tell the truth. I had really, until the 2000 time period, put an inordinate amount of trust, despite the news coverage I'd done on other topics, into our medical system and our medical establishment. I had no idea it was so fraught with conflicts of interest and problems. But as a relationship between the big pharmaceutical company and the media and political figures became more valuable, worth billions of dollars in donations and advertising dollars, it became impossible in a period of time from the early 2000s to the mid-2000 time period, maybe 2005, 2006, 2007, we all noticed a great change in what we are allowed to report and the beginning of this censorship complex, which had been before that really almost unheard of, that you would simply just censor information entirely as a journalist. That became fairly commonplace, not just with medical controversies, but with other stories that I was covering too. And then it became, by 2014, even though my last year I stayed at CBS before leaving my contract early because I was just, you know, not willing to operate under with these issues. My last full year there, I received 3 Emmy nominations and won the Investigative Emmy Award that year because I was still able to do a lot of great reporting, but I could only tell you that more of it was left on what they say the cutting room floor than you ever saw. And it was extremely frustrating to see how certain editorial people were trying to shape and censor information. And that's why I left when I did.
Well, you touched the third rail of investigative journalism when it comes to health. When you started talking somewhat critically about our vaccine campaigns, and this is well before COVID, when COVID provided us with ample reason to challenge the safety and the efficacy of that vaccine. You were talking about vaccine-related issues long ago, right?
Yeah, I was stunned to learn as one of my first assignments in this realm that vaccine had side effects, as silly as that sounds. I was fully vaccinated, my kids fully vaccinated. I just had commit trust. I didn't understand biologically how this worked. I bought into the well-financed narratives that it's crazy to think that vaccines could be linked to autism. I was on board with all of that. And as I began to look into issues, and everybody was in the early 2000s because it wasn't the third rail as much as it is today, and I started to see peer-reviewed published studies we don't hear about that are credible that have long established this relationship with vaccines and autism, but also other side effects and problems with vaccination. And as I had insiders telling me and pointing me to these things, and as I saw court decisions that the government tried to keep hidden or sealed or secret that acknowledged these things, I came to understand this is a huge area that impacts virtually every American, because isn't everybody pretty much, almost everybody vaccinated with something? And yet it came to be, you know, after welcoming that coverage initially at CBS, it came to be that certain powers did not want those stories. And slowly it died out. But I can think of a few things that are more important than the vaccine coverage. And let me mention, it started with covering the smallpox vaccine because they were going to restart the smallpox vaccine program after 9/11. And that's when I first learned, shocking, that vaccines have side effects. They eventually pulled that program off and pulled the smallpox vaccine off the market due to the side effects such as, if it sounds familiar, blood clots and you know, all kinds of myocarditis, heart problems, and so on. And I started to understand the mechanisms, how this can occur medically. It's not crazy talk that, you know, medicine and vaccines can cause you to think that would maybe seem to be unrelated if you don't understand them. And then I revealed that a colleague of mine at NBC News had been embedded with the military during the time we were covering the war in Iraq, and had died of deep vein thrombosis.
David Bloom.
Yeah.
David Bloom. Yeah. Right. Because that was a tragedy. And it was thought that, you know, perhaps he had injured his calf and he hadn't paid attention to it. He was dehydrated. He was in the field. So it was never attributed to the multiple vaccines that he had to undergo to go overseas in a combat zone. It was all kind of yellow fever. A whole panoply
of vaccines. Well, it ultimately was attributed as a result of my reporting, or potentially attributed, because I wagged very early on when I realized he had died of that, and I knew he had gotten a smallpox and anthrax, probably anthrax and other vaccines. Mm-hmm. That was my first question based on the early research I had done was, wow, did he have the smallpox vaccine? Because it's been written that that's a side effect. And the fact nobody was reporting that was shocking. But I did at CBS News. And then I was able to establish that neither the military nor civilian officials had properly reported, as they were required to do, had properly reported his case as a potential adverse event when they were supposed to be monitoring every smallpox vaccine recipient. And as a result of my reporting, he was added to that database. And yet to this day, it's spoken of as if, well, he had pre-existing conditions, right. You know, And what I try to emphasize in the book, because I think a lot of people don't understand this, and I certainly didn't, the fact that you have a pre-existing condition for an illness that occurs after vaccination or a medicine,
it does not exonerate. Exactly. It doesn't exonerate the vaccine.
You're probably at greater risk for that side effect if you have a genetic predisposition. Right. So you should be more careful when recommended for a certain course of treatment. And yet the government and our public health establishment will just often say, oh, that couldn't have been caused by the medicine because he already had a little heart problem or his grandfather had a heart issue.
Yeah. Well, as you well know, and you beautifully explain in your book, Follow the Science, which is a wonderful title for a book because it's kind of an ironic title. Follow the science, they shouted at us when, you know, we suggested other than the conventional narrative. But there has been, and I've noticed this as a physician in practice for, you know, going back to my medical training, 45 years, but in actual practice to the public for 40 years, that there's been a takeover of the science journals by activists. Scientific American, which is for the public, but also for wonky science enthusiasts, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, Wikipedia, especially with their entries, Lancet, BMJ, they're all shifted towards a narrative that I think is pre-authorized and pre-formed so that contrary opinions don't get expressed.
It's so true. And it's, you know, that was another surprising facet to me because I used to think it's something was published in a medical journal, a peer-reviewed published medical journal, for example, where doctors rely on this stuff. I just had no idea how compromised the science is, but you need look only no further than Dr. Marcia Angell, who headed up the New England Journal of Medicine, and the current editor of the British journal Lancet, who have both said, this was some years ago, it's worse today, that much, if not most, of the science and the journals are not to be believed. I mean, it's shocking to hear the journal editors say this because the science has been so co-opted by and studied by the pharmaceutical industry that the journals had not pushed back properly. Dr. Angell said she worked very hard to keep the New England Journal of Medicine pure and to try to push back on this pharmaceutical influence and make the studies actually prove that they were legitimate and not covering up side effects, and she lost the battle. So, you know, that was a big eye-opener to me. Then separately, besides the fact that the pharmaceutical industry is really controlling studies and research and what we learn and what we're allowed to know that comes out of a study, or hiding studies they don't want published because the results were negative, there has also been political activism that has taken place that you described, so that the journals are likewise going to say things about be hyper-focused on climate change without acknowledging it's an open dispute among many scientists as to whether there is man-made climate change and how much we can control it. You're not going to hear that. You're just going to be told there is, and here's all the things that we need to do. And you can follow the money and find the same relative handful of billionaire groups funding nonprofits and people making sure they get positions on journals and at journalism schools, by the way, and on medical boards so that they all advance this same narrative. It's funded by, you know, Craig Newmark of Craigslist. It's funded by Google and Alphabet, you know, the folks that run big tech. It's funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There's just, you know, the same names you see over and over again, pouring billions into saturating our information landscape in ways that are intended to be invisible to us. We're supposed to think everybody agrees on this and all these independent bodies are saying the same thing when strings are really being pulled by a relative handful of interests.
There is a process called peer review, which is the gating process for medical information. If I submit something to a medical journal, it's not automatically going to appear in the medical journal. They may bat it back, saying, well, you know, this part is not clear. Could you rewrite this part? They may not accept it altogether. Ultimately, they may accept it after many, many iterations, a lot of pushback and a lot of shaping of the final article. Something just came out recently, I'm sure you've seen it, which shows that over $8 billion has found its way directly or indirectly into the pockets of peer reviewers from big pharma, pharmaceutical manufacturers, also device manufacturers, because that's actually a big segment of our healthcare budget, devices, implantable defibrillators, artificial joints, etc., that when articles get reviewed, people in effect have a conflict of interest. Maybe they haven't received direct payments. Maybe they didn't receive cash in an envelope, but maybe their research project is funded. Maybe their department is funded. So these payments make their way into the process and ultimately affect the outcome. So when we say follow the science is already tainted.
I assure you that any form of information that can be influenced, they, meaning these powerful interests, have figured out how to do it long before we even considered or recognized it. The peer review process has been hopelessly corrupted with the approval of the medical journals that should be troubleshooting and making sure it doesn't happen. And one example I can give is when I've challenged several studies and managed to get some corrections on them. I'm just a layperson and I can see the studies are hopelessly flawed by just doing a basic reading of them. In some cases, these are federally funded studies using our taxpayer money, maybe funneled through an academic institution. And I have asked who the peer reviewers are because I want to know who would approve such a bad study with a false narrative and what kind of interest they may have. Well, guess what? It's been determined that we don't have the right to know that information. So they will keep the peer reviewers secret. You cannot obtain the information, even though the study was funded with our money. And even if it's putting out information that's subject to a correction, they are now frequently keeping hidden the data, the underlying data, which means to me it's not a valid scientific study if they hide the data and you can't replicate it, but they commonly hide the data when I've asked. And they also will not tell us who the peer reviewers are. They say that's for the peer reviewers' privacy and protection. Well, I think that's just evidence of how conflicted the process has become.
Yeah, as an author of a scientific study, you have to stand behind it. So the peer reviewers who shape the acceptance or lack thereof of the study should also step up. You know that October is Health Literacy Month. And this is an interesting factoid. I wrote an article this month about Health Literacy Month. It's under the auspices of something called the U.S. Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, which has the acronym ODPHP. So it's a governmental agency. Did you even know that your taxpayer dollars were funding such an entity? But they have designated October Health Literacy Month. And that's ostensibly a good goal because doctors are poor communicators. A lot of people don't have access to health information that they understand. So health literacy and the ability to make health decisions for ourselves, I think, is an important skill. This might be more confidence-inspiring if not for the fact that the ODPHP is the very agency under whose auspices the Dietary Guidelines for America were promulgated. Okay, so when it comes to health literacy, I think they kind of struck out, right?
Well, these bodies are typically conflicted by industry. So you can, I hate to say it, but the title of an agency or a group or a nonprofit that proclaims to do one thing.
It's Orwellian.
You can almost assume it does the opposite. And I only say that based on experience when I dug in, certainly not in every case, but I would say most cases, particularly when what they're doing is contrary to common sense. I noted a group that's changed its name now, but it was called Every Child Bites You, was trying to censor my vaccine autism story very early on. And I'd never heard of them and I didn't understand. I remember looking at their website going, gosh, they're all about making sure children have their vaccine by two for children's health. Wouldn't they want to know if the vaccines are causing autism? Like, why are they trying to stop it? And the answer, of course, turned out to be that this was a group started by GlaxoSmithKline, you know, vaccine maker, funded. Their treasurer was on the board and was the founder. And it existed as a group that continually is and was vaccine funded, even though they've changed names, vaccine industry, without disclosing that as they make their proclamations. And then the media is so uncurious that very few of us ask the question. You hear Oh, every child by two said the vaccine autism issue is debunked, or you should get your hepatitis B shot at birth, without understanding if they conflicted group put together by people supported by the vaccine industry. And that exists throughout the medical establishment, the boards and the groups and the American Cancer Society taking funding from the alleged cancer-causing industries in order to, in my view, when you ask the question about whether something causes cancer, they will say, well, you would do much better getting your annual mammograms than worrying about this small risk from this other chemical. You know, they have these pat answers that smack up something going on. And then when you look beneath the surface, you find out there are financial ties.
I think Marty McCary said it very succinctly recently. I'm very familiar with Dr. Marty McCary, who wrote a new book entitled Blind Spots, which is a good companion piece to your book, When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health. And he put it very succinctly. He said, the reason people don't trust the medical establishment is because it lied to them. And I think that we actually are in an interesting moment historically because we have such clear-cut examples of where what was once labeled misinformation and disinformation turned out to be the true veritas when it comes to the COVID experience. So, your book, I think, alludes to that.
Well, here's the thing. The government and medical establishment tends to now blame anti-vaxxers, for example, that vaccination rates are falling or whatnot. It's their fault. You know, once people are not stupid, they start to learn from experience that if government and our medical health establishment has put out false information, they can't rely on that information. They become mistrustful of it. That's how, you know, human beings are in terms of their learning process. And yet then you hear the government blaming the people who are learning from the past and holding them responsible for public health ills. It's so backwards because it's the government themselves that is creating this environment of, you know, skepticism and disbelief. And, you know, I said this was an argument that was made long ago. Every time the government says they can't tell us the truth, internally they will say things or tell reporters, you shouldn't report this, or in essence, you can't tell the truth about this because it creates a public health or a trust confidence problem. And the answer is, I used to hear that argument, it was somewhat compelling initially. I don't want people not to trust our public health officials. I don't want people to stop getting vaccinated, you know, and be scared. And then I started to realize, wait a minute, if the government is creating this mistrust, it's not my job as a journalist to cover it up so that it's convenient for the government. The government will have to deal with the fallout if the truth is known. It's not my job to anticipate what happens. It's my job and my view to put out factual information. And if the government then has to address the fallout from its mistakes and errors, so be it. It's not my job to censor the information for them so that they don't have to deal with that.
And so, Cheryl, what is it with health journalists and medical journalists, present company excluded, people who are in the business of reporting health information often uncritically accept what are essentially press releases from pharmaceutical industry interests, from universities who are conducting studies? And, you know, is it the deadline? Is it laziness? Is it lack of acumen at picking apart a study? Or is it, you know, just groupthink that is causing them to so uncritically parrot the party line?
Well, it's a lot of that. And I'm not a medical reporter. And I think I attribute that to the reason I've been able to break so many medical related stories, whereas those on the beat who know them intimately have not. And I think it's a similar syndrome, maybe Stockholm syndrome type of thing that I found on other beats. The reporters who maybe work, not all of them, so I'm not trying to paint a totally broad book rush, but the reporters who maybe cover the transportation beat or the State Department beat or the White House beat, they tend to become sympathetic of and friendly with those on whom they're supposed to report under the auspices of getting these supposed scoops, you know, all that.
Which it's about access and, you know, whether certainly you are, you know, according to the inside track on a story.
But that's never of value. So as I've shown, the stuff they want to give you that you're calling a scoop because you're a favored reporter believe never anything that's it's propaganda. It's the stuff they want out anyway. They're not going to tell you about the important stuff they don't want you to know about. And I found that I was usually more successful in uncovering information because sometimes they were worried that I had it or knew that I had it, and they would actually give me some information or answers to questions. But in no case did I feel like I was better off for, or I'm sorry, worse off for not being friendly with them or on the beat. And I thought, contrary to that, that the beat reporters tend to not be critical, as critical. They're not asking, I think I put in the book, when I started asking doctors who were promoting controversial medicines uncritically or defending them, when I started asking if they were connected to the drug maker, 100% of the time, either I looked online and could find that they were, or they admitted it. 100% of the time, they're connected to the drug that they had not disclosed this financial relationship with. But I got suspicious because the drug company or the government pointing me to them to defend the drug. And I'm like, why are the medical reporters quoting these same experts and not disclosing their conflict of interest? Best example, Dr. Paul Offit of Children's Hospital. Everybody pointed to him early on to me about proving vaccines can't be connected to autism and are perfectly safe, without reporting that he's a big vaccine industry insider, sits in that chair for a vaccine company and has made millions and millions of dollars on the rotavirus vaccine, which is controversial and causes side effects. And I have a great story, I think, in the book where when I was trying to report an important story that crossed the wires about a possible safety issue with a rotavirus vaccine in children causing a telescopic bowel or intussusception, I'm like, wow, that's really important because they're giving this vaccine to babies with not a great evidence of benefit in this country, because kids for diarrhea, kids don't typically die of diarrhea in the United States. People should know about the possible side effect. So I sent the note up to CBS alerting them to it in New York. I was living in D.C., working in D.C. in the D.C. Bureau. And a note came back from the medical correspondent for CBS that to all the managers that said, oh, I spoke with Dr. Paul Offit, an expert, who says that this is nothing to worry about, we shouldn't report it. And I'm thinking,
But it actually is, you know, one of the black box warnings on the vaccine. I mean, it
wasn't, just right? So at the time it wasn't.
Oh, okay, it wasn't.
And
it emerged.
May I say, Dr. Offit invented the rotavirus vaccine. And this is not an email, like nobody on the email chain, including the medical correspondent, understood that he had called the very doctor who invented the vaccine,
right,
who then defended the vaccine without disclosing, hey, I'm the inventor. So I write back on the email, well, Dr. Offit invented this vaccine, and while it would be fine to put in the story that he says it doesn't cause this, we should report it because this was an independent study and warning. Mm-hmm. The email went back around, and the medical correspondent said, okay, yes, I called Dr. Offit back. You're absolutely right. He did invent this vaccine, but he assured me there was nothing in the clinical trial that lent any credence to the notion that this could be caught. So then, as you accurately point out, eventually this became so overwhelming, the safety signal, that a black box warning was added to the vaccine to warn people about this. But I wondered how many children were injured and died in the meantime because the media didn't report, when we knew it some years before, this safety signal that had occurred because we all went to Dr. Offit, who invented the vaccine, and got his opinion on it, and then decided to censor the story entirely.
Yeah, it's an example of the fox minding the chicken coop, for sure. Cheryl, you're so prolific, and you have some more stories to share with us. You just keep churning out great investigative stories on your program, Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. You also have a very active presence in social media. I presume Instagram. I see you all the time on X. And so people should follow you, but you also have a website and people can then subscribe to Full Measure.
Yeah, I have a Substack. I try to cross post most everything I do at CherylAtkison.com, you know, because there's so many different outlets I try to stay current on. I mostly post more on X or Twitter than anywhere else, although I do try to get around, you know, in case someone censors you or my even on X, I have a decent reach, but it's definitely down throttled, you can tell. So I try to have a reach across on a lot of different places, and I try to, again, cross post most everything at CherylAtkison.com.
Okay. And it's a great example of, you know, how when you're looking for health information, or this being Health Literacy Month, October, that you need to diversify your portfolio. I mean, you can turn on the evening news, you can read the Wall Street Journal, you can read the New York Times, you can go to USA Today. But unfortunately, you're not going to get the full picture. So full measure, aptly titled, you're going to get a full measure with critical investigative reporting on subjects of major concern to you on the health front. So part two, we're going to talk some more. We have some interesting disclosures in the vaccine realm and some other things to share with you. So stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest today, Cheryl Atkison, and this is Intelligent Medicine.